Welcome to We Are Libertarians. We're back after just a little brief hiatus. We've been, I don't know about these guys, but I've been moving offices, and we are now in the high-rise studios of the Libertarian Party of Indiana headquarters. And boys, how glamorous is the studio we're recording in today?
It's like something Katy Perry would use.
Yeah. What does that even mean?
Exactly.
Have you been eating brownies from Denver? So if it sounds a little bit different, not as high quality as our normal podcast, that's why. So switched offices. Now that the election is over, we moved out of Rupert's podcast studio and we're back over at LPIN HQ. And so we had to take a little break to move all that stuff. Well, I did. These guys didn't do a darn thing. As always, I'm Chris Spangle. That's Chris Galt in the weird Windows 8 glasses, and Creighton Harrington looking suave as ever. So let's break down the elections. Let's start with the presidential race, and then we'll kind of go down the ballot, and then we'll wind up going to pot. So,
all right.
What are your guys' thoughts on the election? Are you surprised by Obama's victory, Creighton Harrington?
Oh my God, no! Doesn't it just feel awesome to be vindicated for saying the same thing for a year, and then it happened exactly like you said it was going to?
And this is this week's first "I told you so."
Yes, I know, man. Oh my God, I don't. I'm not glad that he won.
I'm not either.
But at the same time, I am glad that I was right. Despite all the yelling and pointing at my face saying that you're wrong. Well,
you guys are insignificant,
right.
And you don't have any bearing on the election.
Now, what are you guys referring to?
Oh,
just arguments I've had with people throughout this entire presidential race, from the beginning till the end. Mitt Romney was the only hope.
I did think Romney would win, to be honest with you. I thought that Romney would pull it out.
That's what she said.
It would have really hurt the Liberty Movement if he won.
I thought that things are so bad, and you look at the discontentment and the hatred of the gridlock and all that. Like, he's really been a do-nothing president other than, you know, escalate wars and Obamacare, and nobody likes either of those. So I was surprised he didn't pull it out. So I think the reason he ended up, Obama won re-election was Sandy.
No. I disagree completely. I mean, the fact that he did so bad and he still won is telling as to how bad the Republican Party sucks. I mean, that's really ultimately what it comes down
that's
to.
True.
Sandy helped. Don't get me wrong. Sandy helped, but no, Barack Obama won because the Republican Party's full of a bunch of idiots.
Oh, yeah.
And they ran the moderate candidate again. And they basically shut their – I mean, even just listening to like people like Rush Limbaugh, you know, who's not really the party guy. He's the voice, you know. He's the conservative, quote, quote. I mean, even people like that, Greg Garrison here in the city. And these people had, you know – They were against Mitt Romney for a number of reasons, but none of them was because of social issues.
Right.
And social issues were one of the biggest things that killed the Republican Party because they closed their eyes, covered their ears, and imagined that half of America would agree with them that hating people will get you elected. And
right.
The best example is Murdoch and Aiken. I mean, they were in the lead until they talked about social issues, and then they lost.
You just lost a Senate race in Indiana because you're too pro-life. You must be a bad candidate.
I know. I mean, it's...
That one surprised me.
I will say... I did think that he was going to pull an upset and come back and win just because it was Indiana. And I was like,
I thought
he was going to do it. But I'm not surprised he lost. But at the same time, I thought maybe since it was Indiana, he had a little bit of a handicap over the Democrat.
Yeah.
But
when I pulled that tape at my precinct and I saw, oh man, Donnelly beat Murdoch here, and then Greg was way not even close to Pence, I was like, just lost. It's because I was in a real Republican area.
Yeah, and I was actually surprised. Well, let's stick to the presidential race. But
okay.
What are your thoughts on the presidential race?
Completely. I mean, we had less voter turnout than 08. Yeah. And I think it's all because, I mean, people can look at this presidential election and how many people listening to this know one issue that Mitt Romney stood on. What was his stance on any issue?
I'll tell you the issue that everybody...
You don't know. Was he pro-life?
No, I'll tell you the issue everybody remembers. I mean, 47%. That's what everybody remembers.
Right, right.
They remember his stupid comments because he's so bland and unlikable. Well, I won't say unlikable. He's so bland and middle of the road that when he says something stupid like that, that's what everybody remembers because he has no... He's not outspoken on anything except stupid comments. And that's another reason that it killed him. It's because when you're in the middle on everything, when you say something stupid, that's what everybody remembers.
Well,
because
look at what his statements after the election. Have you guys heard that? Where he's basically like, basically Obama gave the blacks and the Mexicans free stuff.
I swear to God, I have never seen anyone get thrown under the bus so quickly as Mitt Romney has post-election. I mean, he was like the golden child of the Republican Party for, you know, the entire election. And then a week later, everybody's like, Mitt Romney sucks. Let's move on. I mean, everybody's like
Marco Rubio for president.
Yeah.
That's their new one now.
Have you heard
any mention of Rand Paul?
I've heard some.
They don't want him.
Well, I know the establishment guys don't want him, but I've seen media pundits have been like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio are kind of like the go-to people for 2016. And Bobby Jindal. God, Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal. Mr. Personality.
Yeah.
Were you guys surprised by how poorly Gary Johnson did? Because I know Gary Johnson was, and so was I. I mean, and that's sort of the thing that post-election I've struggled with. You look at the results. Gary Johnson here in Indiana doubled what we did 4 years ago. Rupert doubled what we did 4 years ago. In the Indiana governor's race, you know. So, in that respect, it is the best result libertarians have ever had. But there's still a bit of depression because the vibe was so intense before the election. You felt like, man, there's no way we're not going to hit 5%. He's polling at 7 or 8. I mean, so it sort of was a letdown afterwards, despite looking at the facts, and the facts are that we doubled in Indiana what we've done for the presidential race. It still was kind of a bummer.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed at first, and then I thought about it for a while, and I read Reason magazine and had a big article in there.
Right.
They wrote before the election, but it came out after, and it was just about, can Gary Johnson get 1%?
Right.
And all of the good that would come if he just got 1%. And that's what he did. He got 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And the chair of the LP said that 1% would be really hard to get a million votes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he did it. Yeah. He got a million votes.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, there are a million people in America that are finally fed up with two parties.
I think what's interesting.
Government.
And kind of in that same kind of line, is if you look at the numbers of people who voted Paul in the primary compared to the difference between Romney and Obama and the actual general and the swing states, the Ron Paul primary voters were more than the difference between Obama and Romney.
Right.
And the assumption, I mean, obviously not every single one of them probably voted for Mitt Romney or voted for Gary Johnson or didn't vote or something. Someone probably voted for Mitt Romney. But nevertheless, it's pretty interesting. It could have lost him the election.
It's asinine to say that Gary Johnson cost Mitt Romney the election because that's just mathematically not true.
Mm-mm.
It's probably not untrue to say that Ron Paul was a major contributor to the loss of Mitt Romney, though, for the following reasons. You had a passionate base of new Republicans, people who, I mean, you guys, I would assume, voted for Ron Paul in the primary, but you didn't vote for Mitt Romney, and you guys are not traditional. You guys aren't 78-year-old white lawyers, so you're not the typical Republican base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the party lost you. They did nothing to go after you.
They didn't want us.
They didn't want you.
Oh, yeah, if they would have nominated Ron Paul, we would have had volunteers making phone calls for the GOP every day of that election.
Right.
Would have been we probably would have had door-to-door campaigns for the Republican Party here for president.
And
they didn't do that for Mitt Romney.
Because the Republican Party is monolithic, they would have supported Ron Paul over Mitt Romney. They would have treated him like they did with Mitt Romney or with John McCain. Well, he's not our favorite, but he's not a socialist, so let's get him. You know, what is, after Ron Paul lost the primary, was there anything that the Republican Party could have done with Mitt Romney to keep you guys and get you to vote for Mitt Romney?
I did not like Mitt Romney because of his record before he ever started running for president. So there's really little they could have done to
me. Maybe Romney Paul.
Maybe making him vice president.
Maybe.
Maybe. Even though he'd have absolutely no power.
I wouldn't. I mean, I wouldn't. I would have liked that just because it would have been cool because Ron Paul would be in the White House. But nevertheless, vice president doesn't do anything.
Yeah, but many times vice presidents run for president and win the next time.
That's true. But
yeah, we're talking about eight years.
We are.
And then, Ron ain't got 16 years.
But a Paul vice president would really give his son a good rep for president.
And that's better
than what he's got now. If Ron Paul was vice president, Rand Paul would, take it hands down, in my opinion.
That's sort of been the irritating thing to me, is that this entire exercise with the Ron Paul revolution in 2012 has felt like a prelude to Rand Paul 2016. You know, I don't know why it irritates me. I really can't explain it, but it just sort of, like the day after the election, Rand Paul says, "Well, I'm going to Iowa, forming an exploratory committee today. See you soon." Like, oh God, politicians, stop! Just stop running for office. Give us till at least February.
Yeah, no, I mean,
please.
It is kind of sad that not even a week after the election was over, you saw headlines: 2016 race right underway.
The freaking day after. And you know what? Rand and Rubio and all these guys have to do that because they want to be first, and you don't know when the other guy's going to do it, and the media starts asking, so, well, better go.
Yep.
You know, so.
Yep. Now, I mean, I've been watching a little more pundits than I normally do because post-election stuff, I want to hear what the masses are thinking, I guess.
Right.
And he said he's heard some Rand Paul stuff. I hear... The GOP has to survive by getting the Hispanic vote in 2016.
It's all about the Hispanic vote. Yeah,
it's not about the Libertarian vote at all.
I haven't heard any Republican pundits say Rand Paul's the answer. I've just been hearing, Daily Caller. Who's the 2016 hopefuls?
Yeah, so...
I wrote an article about that. It's funny how immediately after this, it never crept through the guys' heads that are running this party, the Republican Party, that it might be... because you guys were too much like Democrats that you lost. And the answer to their problems, they say, people like Bill Kristol, is we need to get the Hispanics by sounding more like Democrats.
Right.
And it's infuriating. It's like, give me a break.
That's why Republicans are championing mass transit here locally. I mean, it's...
they're completely reading the wrong sentiment out of it. I mean, they're under the assumption they lost because Barack Obama was a gimme-gimme president. He'll give you anything. But that's not true. They lost because the Republican Party is so out of step with people's sentiment. I'd say the number one reason they lost is because they told people that that we don't like you.
Right.
I mean, regardless, they reneged on their small government, philosophy, and then they said, and those who accept entitlements, we don't like you,
Right.
And people, I mean, they've done tons of polls. People vote for the guy they think likes them over anything. I mean, voters are very gullible.
The problem with
democracy.
All parties is, and I really saw it more than ever before this election cycle. Always kind of felt it, but I've never seen it as naked as it was. When you're standing next to Rupert and you've got tens of thousands of people coming through your booth a week, maybe not tens of thousands a week, but a month. The 70% of people who don't vote. We, as the political class, tailor our messages to, Republicans tailor their message to fight with Democrats or, to not be called out by Democrats and vice versa, and Libertarians call out both. And, the problem is that parties need to reach out to the 70% of people who don't vote. And that's one of the things that Ron Paul does. And that's one of the things that Libertarians do, is they reach out to the people who have stopped voting because they don't feel represented, or they've never voted before because they just don't feel like there's anything to vote for and they don't believe in the system. And
I think, it comes down to the message. I mean, what is Ron Paul's message? His message was never, hate Democrats and hate Republicans. He says, I disagree with them, and it's particularly on foreign policy. But for the most part, his message was, let's try liberty. I mean, if you could just sum it up, that's really what. Let's try that.
Right.
And so many people caught on to that. They're like, that's the best thing I've ever heard ever.
How many people do we know in the libertarian movement? And I would say that Republican libertarians and libertarian libertarians, how many people do we know that are here because they heard Ron Paul or they've heard Gary Johnson or Andy Horning or Rupert or any of these guys, and they've never voted before, they've never been involved, and they're not really party people, but they believe in the philosophy. I mean, the majority of people that I know are not from a former party. They're just people who heard somebody that actually sounds like they represent them and starts voting for them.
That's why on campus all the liberals are always like, we got to get out the vote. We got to get more people to vote, higher turnout every year. And I'm just like, give them more choices and more people will vote.
Right.
If there were 10 choices on the ballot and each of them had a chance to win, more people would vote.
Right.
You'd have more choices, someone that represents you instead of these left and right that are the same.
And that's the folly of the wasted vote argument is especially with Republicans, economic choice is good. You want more choice in economics and in business because that's good. But in the arena of ideas and elections, it's not good. You know, and that's the problem with the wasted vote argument is every exit poll in 2008, 2010, this year, it shows that it's about a third, a third, a third. The majority of people who vote libertarian are either new libertarian voters or they would not vote for one of the candidates, or they draw from both parties equally. You know, I mean, it really, you see it in exit polling, and that's I'm here as a libertarian. If it were Rand Paul versus Gary Johnson in 4 years as a libertarian president, I'd vote for Gary Johnson, hands down, because he's a little more of a civil libertarian, which is the thing that I care about. And mostly I care about growing a third party. We desperately need to grow a third party and have more choices. You know, so if it came down to that, if it came down to Rand or Gary in four
don't
years.
Don't ask me that.
Don't ask you.
Don't finish that sentence.
All right.
I love Gary Johnson.
It's like Sophie's Choice for you.
I would probably be the same.
If Gary Johnson and Rand Paul were hanging off the side of the boat and you could only save one.
Let me tell you this. If Rand Paul and Gary Johnson were both on the ballot in 2016 in the general election, it would be, I would be
You'd
the
be
happiest
ecstatic.
Person.
Yeah.
Yeah. That we have two Liberty candidates for president on the ballot.
Right.
I mean.
So let's move on to the Senate race. Let's move on to Richard Murdoch, Joe Donnelly, and Andy Horning here in Indiana. And as always, I know we have worldwide listenership, but we are based. We do. Don't laugh. I was actually being serious and not mocking ourselves at that time. We have people all around the world listening, but we are an Indiana-based podcast.
Can we give a shout out to our Zimbabwe listeners?
We can. Yes. So lucky for you, this is free because you couldn't afford it if it weren't.
$1 trillion per episode.
So we are an Indiana-based podcast, so we're going to talk about some of the Indiana races. So if you don't want to hear that, then fast forward. Sorry about you. Were you surprised, Creighton Harrington, that Richard Murdoch lost?
Surprised might be too strong of a word. I didn't expect. I thought that he was going to pull. I mean, I knew he was doing bad because of the whole rape comment.
Right. Well, that's understating it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
That's he threw the election away because of the rape comment.
I understood that, but I still
I'm not going to say what I was going to say.
I still thought because it's Indiana that just the fact that he was Republican would have made up the difference. But and you know what? And there's a telling reason why.
It's a historical election when a Republican in Indiana loses an election for being too pro-life.
No, I tell you what, it wasn't that. It wasn't that at all. It was the fact that he sounded like a chauvinist. And my mom actually, I mean, she's not into politics outside of just voting. I mean, that's what she does. She never really even talks about it. I remember I asked her who she voted for in 08 and she wouldn't tell me. And I knew she voted for I knew she voted for McCain. But
that's why she wouldn't tell you.
Yeah, her grandparents, my great grandparents, they worked with the Republican Party, like volunteers and stuff a lot. So I mean, she had been raised kind of as a Republican. So I knew that's how she voted. But she's not outspoken at all.
Right.
She said that she voted for Andy Horning for Senate because she didn't like Murdoch. But she didn't like Democrats so much that she voted for Andy Horning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's my mom. I mean, she is the normal voter. I mean, in your head, if you picture the average Joe voter, that's my mom. And she voted for Andy Horning, which, I mean, an average Joe voter voting for Andy Horning because you so dislike a Republican when you don't even pay attention to politics.
Right.
I mean, that's just telling. It's because he sounded like a chauvinist. My dad was like, you know, everybody knows what he meant. But my mom was like, I don't care. He sounded like an a-hole.
Right.
And it wasn't so much because he was pro-life. He was too pro-life. It's just because he straight up said, hey, women, it's okay if you get raped.
I mean, it's funny. My dad and my brother are diehard Republicans, and they had planned on voting for Andy Horning before the rape comment. And then after the rape comment, when it became panic time, they said, well, we can't let Nancy Pelosi be in charge of the Senate. And I go, oh,
they really said that?
Sweet. Dear mother of God, yes, they really said that. My brother did. He's very well informed. And if you don't understand why that's funny, read a newspaper. So,
if you don't understand why that's funny, you're listening to the wrong podcast.
You haven't made it 22 minutes into the podcast yet. But so they've ended up voting for Murdoch, even though they had planned it.
So the rape comment switched them back the other way.
Right. They were going to vote for Andy. Because they just thought Murdoch was creepy. And somehow, post-rape comment, they felt that he was not creepy enough to... I don't know. It just...
Yeah.
Listen, they did the whole Democrats are worse.
Yeah. You really see this the last couple weeks. When you are out canvassing and talking to voters or talking to your friends and family because they're coming to you and asking you questions because you're the political one in the family, there's just no telling what people will respond to. I'm voting for that guy because he has a good website. I'm voting for that guy because he doesn't have his email address clearly on the contact page. You know, I'm voting for that guy because I hate his website. It has too much red. I mean, it's not just all websites. It's just the weirdest little, you know, nuances will shift a voter's opinion.
He wore a blue tie.
Right.
He has more red in his tie than the other guy.
I hate that guy because he's rich.
He likes my brand of coffee. He likes Pepsi. I don't like him.
Right. It's just really weird, the nuances that people will have.
Yeah.
I personally was not surprised that Murdoch lost. His campaign was a disaster from start to finish. Mm. You know, you're too heavily tied to the Tea Partiers. And, you know, I really hope that the GOP doesn't divorce themselves from the Tea Party, because that does nothing but help the Libertarian Party. I mean, it's the Libertarians' fault. It's Andy Horning's fault that we don't have control of the Senate now. No, actually, it's Christine O'Donnell, Todd Akin, Richard Murdoch,
yeah,
Sharon Engel.
Yeah, it's their fault for opening their mouths because they're stupid.
Right. You elect these, you know, the rhinos must just be sitting back snickering.
No, but at the same time, you know what? I am kind of... I mean, Murdoch isn't a great candidate, and it's not surprising that he lost. And I know that the Eastern establishment type of Republicans are sitting back. They're like, well, they had to get rid of Richard Lugar, and if they wouldn't have gotten rid of Lugar,
yeah, nobody would have even ran against Lugar.
And I said it right when they called that Murdoch was going to lose. I was like, I'm going to say it before all the other Republicans start saying it. I am okay with the fact that Richard Lugar lost, and we lost to a Democrat because he voted for TARP. And he deserved to lose for that reason alone. So,
and I don't think that Lugar probably would have squeaked out a win, but it wasn't going to be like it was in 2006 when he beat, Steve Osborne, the Libertarian, 75-25, something like that. I mean, it was going to be a tight race because of that sentiment and because Republicans were going to be lukewarm on him, just like they were with Mitt Romney. And Donnelly was still going to run, and Donnelly would have been, being a pro-life, pro-gun sort of blue dog Democrat, he was going to be competition for Lugar.
Maybe.
He was competition for Murdoch.
How much did Horning pull?
About 6%. He held the line of the percentage of what Rebecca Sink-Burris did in 2010, and he had about 100. Last I checked, the votes aren't certified for 5 or 6 more days. He had almost as many votes as Steve Osborne did in 2006 in a two-way race with Richard Lugar. He had a tremendous amount of votes. So, but his percentage his percentage just kind of held where Rebecca was, but still a really, really positive outcome. I think Murdoch's campaign just got off to a bad start. Once they, you know, I remember because I was actually invited to be the token libertarian to the beer summit after the 2010 primary.
Token libertarian.
The token libertarian. I have a lot of peers in both parties, you know, in all three parties, that I still hang out with a lot of people from the Republican and the Democratic parties, and we chat, and you don't give away your party secrets, but you do commiserate and whine about, you know, people in parties that give you trouble, or talk just about what went right or wrong in those campaigns and gossip. And, you know, in 2010... after the primary where Dan Coats won, it was a contentious primary. Marlon Stutzman and Dan Coats and Bainey and all these guys had a contentious primary, and Dan Coats ended up winning because of name ID. Well, they all got together and had a beer summit, you know, making fun of the famous Obama, you know, cop from what was Harvard, had a beer summit. So they all got together and they invited me over, so I went over, and then they made fun of me and told me that Ron Paul Republicans get kicked out of the party, but I should come back home and all that good stuff. That didn't happen this time. After Luger beat Murdoch, Murdoch's team were sore winners, and they told a lot of the Luger supporters and the establishment Republicans to go screw themselves. And so you had a party structure that is the money part of this of the established Republican Party that just didn't turn out for you. I mean, after Murdoch's rape comments, he only raised $100,000. You think, oh, well, he got $100,000 after he made that comment? Well, he should have gotten $1 million, because that meant that he was in jeopardy and they were going to lose the Senate. So as the Republican Party would usually do, they'd flood money into the race to try and raise his numbers back up. But they didn't do that. They donated $100,000 as opposed to $1 million or $2 million. Yeah. You know, so the party was just not there. And a lot of that stems from the behavior of the campaign and its campaign manager specifically. And that continued all throughout. And, you know, if it had been Mike Pence that had made the same comment,
he
would have gotten the benefit of the doubt, because he had given a back to the Republican Party. He had, you know, he ran a disciplined race, and he didn't make anybody mad or anything like that. Now he's again. He guess he can't help himself. He's shoving his thumb right in the eye of Romney, saying that, well, I ran a clean race and I won, which is just stupid on its face. But you know, Pence would have gotten the benefit of the doubt. Murdoch didn't, despite having run 10 times and having gone to every Lincoln Day dinner between now and 2002, he didn't get the benefit of the doubt because of the behavior and the discipline of his campaign and the way it was run. And I think it's an interesting view of how to run a race and how not to run a race, the difference between Pence and Murdoch, because they're the same guy. I mean, it's just a tale of Goofus and Gallant as far as campaigns go. So any other thoughts on Murdoch?
No. I will say, kind of tying into the jumping back to the whole concept of, you know, we got to move back. We got the Republican Party has to move to the center now and get the Hispanic vote and all this crap. I wrote it in that article the other day. If you want to look at who ended up actually winning all their races that were Republican, look at, you know, the people endorsed by the Liberty Movement. The Ron Paul Republicans all won their, I mean, except like two. I think a guy in Rhode Island lost, and a guy in the dude in Missouri, Kurt Bills, lost.
Amash won.
Ted Cruz won. Yep. Thomas Massey won. Flake. The guy out in Idaho won. Flake won. All of them won, and they were the, you know, the Ron Paul Republicans, and all of the, you know, Richard Murdoch-style, Todd Akin-style Republicans lost.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how you can have a better, like, survey or experiment than that.
There's also the difference is that a lot of those guys are younger. Akin and Murdoch are older. And I don't know what it is about the media, but to be fair to Murdoch and those guys, what they said was inexcusable and stupid. But Murdoch said something he didn't mean. It was not his intention. But the media still spun it to, you know, to, I mean, did you guys see Flake's commercial in Arizona about his opponent? I mean, it was bad. it was effective, but because it was so bad, I mean, just basically, you know, this guy basically murders people, and we're not sure how many people he's murdered, but, you know, he didn't. By the way, my opponent didn't murder and kill someone back in 1993. That's an outrageous lie. That kind of style of politics. And I think the media is more sympathetic to small L libertarians than they are that social conservative, you know, and I think that's because a lot of media are small L libertarians. They're well, really just kind of,
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Independent minded, or, you know, if they're not flaming liberals,
I'd say they're libertarian on social issues, which is the same way as saying they're liberal on social issues.
Right.
But, I don't think it holds for economic issues.
Oh, so Barack Obama's libertarian on social issues?
No, he's liberal.
No,
on
we're
social
talking about
issues.
The media. Media.
And he's not liberal on social issues too. I mean, he's raided more drug dispensaries and deported more illegal immigrants and all this kind of stuff.
Basically, so. Just said he's not going to even touch gay marriage.
Anti-civil liberties. I mean, he is the opposite. Rhetoric-wise, he's excellent, isn't he?
Let's go back to Barack Obama, because we didn't really touch on Obama. How big of a disaster do you think the next 4 years are going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty bad. And I tell you what, I think the economy is going to tank after Christmas sales come in. I think when Christmas sales come in way lower than everybody expected, I think the economy is going to tank.
Yep.
And I think we're going to be in another recession by, you know, March next
year. I'll go a step further and say the stock market crashes next year.
It's already going down a bunch now. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's just a result of, like, kind of this whole fiscal cliff thing, but that's just nothing. It's
right.
Once those bad profit margins start showing up, it's just going to be a spiral, and it's going to be next year.
Yeah,
we
once
got Twinkies going out of business.
Yeah,
I mean,
I thought the world was ending.
Yeah, no, the Twink.
Let's
oh
pause. Let's pause and cover something important. How the do you lose money on cupcakes and Twinkies?
Unions. No, that's how. They're going out of business because of a freaking strike. I swear to God. I hope every person in America, you know, that loves Twinkies goes out there and starts on an anti-union campaign, because this is a perfect example of how union philosophy is stupid.
Okay, here's the story. The Hostess Company, which employs about 800 people here in Indiana, 18,000 people across the nation, there was a strike. It started about last week, but there's been labor disputes like crazy. And so the Teamsters, the company basically said, you need to cut your pay by 8%, and we need to shave some benefits, because we're not going to survive as a company if we don't.
In this economy.
And the bankers, the bakers, you know, the union of confectioners and alcoholics.
Bakers, he said.
But basically, the bakers union told the company to go screw themselves. And the company came back and said to the Teamsters, which are truckers, and to the bakers, no, we're serious. We're going to file bankruptcy if we don't have a deal by the end of next week. Oh, that's just your strong-arm tactics. The Teamsters abandoned solidarity and signed a deal. The bakers held out, and so the Hostess Company filed bankruptcy today. When the let me put it this way. When the Teamsters Union, who killed Hoffa, who killed their leader and buried him under Giant Stadium, abandoned you from solidarity and crossed the picket line. I mean, Trumka is a Teamster. That ought to tell you. Richard Trumka, Glenn Beck's best friend. That's how serious this was. And the bakers still just didn't get it, and now they're all out of jobs. They're out of work. They're out of, you know.
Yeah, 18,000 people are going to be unemployed.
Unemployed. And this is happened here in Indiana with the stamping plant. Was it GM or Chrysler?
I have no idea.
I think it was the
Was it Allison's?
No.
No, Allison just almost had this happen.
Okay. I think it was a GM stamping plant here in Indianapolis. And the union just would not sign a deal, and so GM said, well, sorry, we're closing the plant. And they closed the plant.
This is just the beginning, man.
Right.
I'm telling you what. I mean, it's hard to be – I mean, yeah, I don't want to sound like a Debbie Downer after this election, because, I mean, I hate Obama,
it's
too.
All I've been like on Facebook.
But I'm telling you what,
like,
man, the economy – you know, now that the politics part is over and the economic law part starts hitting in, I mean, we are – in a
trouble.
Very happy moment right now, until all this stuff starts to hit the fan, because it's going to.
Right.
I'm making the call right now. Next year is not going to be a fun year, and I think, a lot of people.
I think you're right. I mean, we have gridlock, and you're not going to get anything done in Washington. We're going to hit the fiscal cliff, whatever that is. Yep. And
you know, and on that
sequestration. Well, hold on, sequestration, and then combine all of that despair and the lack of austerity within our government with the bad sales numbers. You could be totally right. We could be really hurting in February.
I mean, everybody forgets the Great Depression was two different recessions.
Right.
There was a period of growth between 1929 to 1945.
Right.
You know, I think it was 1931 to 33. I think
33 is when it hit.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was like a good 2 years of actual growth, of not recession. And then it tanked again. And the second crash of the Depression was the hard part.
Right.
1929 to 1931 wasn't near as bad as 33 and onward.
Right.
2008 to 2012.
I mean,
is going to be as bad as 2013 to 2016?
It's 2018. It's pretty bad. But on that sequestration thing, I've been saying it on Twitter a lot. People need to make sure they understand that this is all, you know, a gimmick. And this whole sequestration idea is, and Obama's saying we need a balanced approach to fix it. We need to raise taxes on the rich and we'll cut spending some too. And the thing is that none of this spending cuts are, these cuts are real. It's all reducing the growth of spending. The absolute amount of dollars spent this year will still be more, or will still be less than next year. It's just not going to be as big of a difference. So when they say they're going to raise taxes, they're actually literally going to raise taxes. People will be paying more to the federal government out of their pocket.
Yep.
But when it comes to actually how much money the federal government will be spending on things, it will still be more than this year. It's just not going to be that much, as much more as they had hoped. So this whole sequestration thing is just infuriating, because they're talking about how we have to have a balanced approach. But you're not going to have a balanced approach. You're just cutting the growth in spending. You're not cutting spending. You're cutting its growth. That's not cuts. That's fake. When I cut spending on stuff, I spend less than I was previously spending, not
right.
less than I planned on spending in the future.
Well, that's the problem, is that, like, John Gregg, the governor's candidate here in Indiana, campaigned on being the only candidate in the race to ever balance a budget. Well, he never balanced a budget. He just didn't follow through on fiscal promises that the state made to, like, universities and schools and hospitals. They just didn't pay what they were. They just didn't pay their bills, and then he said, "Well, we balanced the budget." No, you didn't. It's all gimmicks and tricks, and that's the problem with a growing government. That's the problem with growing the size of government, is they tell you a load of bullcrap. It sounds like they know what they're talking about, and then you just keep growing the size of government until you get to a point like, well, you're Greece or Zimbabwe.
And don't all the tax cuts expire in the year?
Yeah, yes. What it is the Bush tax cuts expire on January 1st, and that's when the automatic cuts are. And most of the cuts are in defense. And it's not like they're going to – GDP – they're saying that if we cut all this spending, then GDP is going to go down by like 2%. And I don't see that happening. That's based on a CBO estimate. I don't see that happening, because most of the cuts, a majority of the cuts, come from the Defense Department, and they're not going to stop building ships, and that's the only thing that contributes to GDP,
right,
is the amount that they pay their workers and the amount that they buy building, like, battleships. They're not going to cut that. The Pentagon's never been audited. There's a ton of waste in the Pentagon, and they're going to try and get rid of that waste before they start cutting back on buying stuff. I don't think the GDP is going to go down near as much as they're predicting.
And Congress doesn't want to cut the military budget, because planes and, you know, tanks and armored carriers, they're made in their districts.
And
I don't want to get rid of something that employs people in my district.
They're not cutting the absolute amount of spending in the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of spending that will be going from the Defense Department into the economy will be higher than it would be this year, than it was this year, with the cuts.
Right.
Everyone needs to remember, every time they say cuts, they're talking about reducing the amount of spending growth.
Right.
There's still going to be a positive difference between spending next year and this year. They're not cuts. They're fake. They're not real. They are an accounting gimmick.
Are they fake?
They are fake.
So I was reading on NBC market analysis people. I don't remember the guy's name, but because I don't really care his name.
Get ready to be informed, people.
No. But
What's his face? You know,
it was what's his face on that one show with the thing.
No, bulls and bears.
This is going to be solid information for you.
Well, we're talking about the economy tanking, and he was. They were talking about if there's not a serious change in policy in D.C., I mean, we're going to see a societal collapse in 5 to 10 years globally. And I really don't see that there's going to be any change in policy in D.C. with a. I mean, we have a Republican House,
America,
and a Democrat president.
America and the dollar are the blood of the entire world economic system. I mean, it's.
Yep.
You know,
well, Germany's calling for all their gold back.
Yep.
China is too. China's not using the dollar anymore to buy anything globally.
So in 5 to 10 years, you can listen to We Are Libertarians with a
I told
red,
you so.
A red solo cup. A red solo cup and
yep.
a string.
In a tent.
We'll have a whole network of. So how much longer do you got, Galt?
I got 5 minutes.
Okay.
But
we'll start wrapping it up soon.
All right.
Well, we can keep going. I got plenty of time.
Oh, okay.
You're just going to have me hang out here for an hour or two because we had to do the podcast so early.
No, he said if we see some change in policies, we'll have another pretty bad recession.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say.
Yeah, stop talking, Galt.
The
fiscal, needs to go
the,
now.
You know, he's talking. He's the money guys might be talking about the fiscal cliff specifically. I'm not sure.
Right.
But... you know, while this fiscal cliff stuff's going to be in the news, that is not nearly the problem. The real problem is that, you know, the present value of all our future obligations total over $200 trillion, which is, like, more than the world GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just American liabilities. I mean, that's ridiculous. There is literally no way in this universe or any other that we could pay that off if we don't change anything. And there is literally there's no incentive for politicians to change that at all. There's no they have no way to do it because pretty much because it's all old people. I tell you the truth, it's Social Security and Medicare. It's mostly Medicare,
right?
And
even libertarians, I mean, LP people that I talk to that are older and on Social Security, they get real angry with me when I start saying we need to reform Social Security. But it's true. I don't expect to see it, and. You know, yeah, you paid into it, and I've paid into it, and I should get my money back, or I should get the service that I paid for. But going forward, I am willing to make a sacrifice. I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm willing to kill Medicare. You know, I don't ever want to, you know, I'll pay into it for a certain amount of time, but I'm never going to see Medicare in my lifetime.
Well,
or you know.
There is no paying into it. I mean, that's
not, kinda, any, not anymore.
No, it never was. It's pay as you go. It never was set up to where you pay and then you take out when you retire. It's always you paying to the people that are old now.
Yeah.
And that's another thing people don't really like to understand.
Ew, old people, gross.
Well, I posted something on my Facebook about food stamps or welfare, and I got some comments from some Democrats, and basically they were like, well, we've paid into this our whole lives. So I get food stamps now, and I paid into it. I'm 45. You know, I've paid my whole life into the government. Why shouldn't I get food stamps?
But have they really?
I mean, yeah, like, they probably have paid a lot of money to the government, and they deserve every dollar they've given the government, but it's gone. Every dollar that they've given them is gone. Mm-hmm. And spent.
I mean, yeah, people need to remember, you're not paying into some big old pile that everybody's taking out of.
No.
It's directly going to other people.
Right.
So when you get it paid back, it's coming from other people. Individuals who have their own lives and their own families, that's who's paying you to have food stamps or to have this health care, to have the 18 different checkups that you need because your foot hurts. I mean, it's not coming from some pile of money sitting in D.C. It's coming from other people's pockets in the present. It's not in some bank account accruing interest. It's coming out of people's pockets.
Right.
And it's coming out at such a rate that it's destroying our country. It's not...
It's going to end at some point. It's just, how is it going to end? Is it going to end by our choice on our terms, or is it going to end by violent destruction?
Yeah, and I would love to talk about this more, because, I mean, I want to know what you guys think the government will do when crap hits the fan. Are we going to see a New Deal, too? Or, I mean, but I got to leave.
Oh.
So...
Oh, really? What do you got? What is so much... What is more important than this podcast?
I have student government.
You know, you're so disrespectful to our listeners, Chris.
Honestly, I would go late if I wasn't having my bill voted on today.
Okay.
So I can't be late.
Yeah, but you paid off all the other members. what sort of IUPUI pork are you trying to push?
Oh, just trying to get rid of regulations.
Did you pass a law?
Well, I haven't
like scumbag
passed anything.
Creighton, huh?
I don't know. I'm pretty polarizing when I go up there, and
shocking.
They think I have some kind of hidden agenda every time I introduce a bill. So we'll see what happens. This might be the first one I get passed.
I can
though.
See them imagining him as like Emperor Palpatine, like playing both sides. Oh
against no,
each other.
He's Jar Jar Binks. All right, good riddance. Hey, don't wear those glasses when you go in. Before you go, Creighton, can you get a shot of Galt with his glasses on for the Facebook page?
I should have worn my hat. You would have loved it. It totally matches.
So we'll put that up on wearelibertarians.com. Go check out our Facebook page.
Yeah, but I think we're taking a small break from our podcast for the next month.
Yep, what we're
going to
do
so,
is we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus. We're going to a few things are in the works. We're going to retool a couple things.
Plus Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
Christmas.
And Christmas. And I'm probably not going to make it past Thanksgiving. I'm going to eat a lot of food, a lot of pie. But no, we're looking at building a website and actually doing a couple things right and being a little more diligent about the podcast and taking this seriously because you, valued listener, are important to us. So
yes, you are.
Yeah, so
listener.
don't if you don't see a podcast for a while, don't delete us from your iTunes or from your Downcast or your Instacast. We'll be back. It's just going to be a little
or
bit of a
break. Or your Stitcher, Rivertown Radio to throw
Rivertown Radio, Stitcher, Liberty Osmosis, all of our friends and partners and beloved downloaders and Facebook. So
Mark Zuckerberg is a great sponsor. He gives us a free page on his website.
Right. wearelibertarians.com. Go like
Until
the page.
We tell people about it.
And then keep up with what's going on. We always try to update that every few days with something ridiculous. So let's move on now that Chris Galtz is gone. Let's talk about General Petraeus. Because I have a question for you. I mean, I've barely followed the story. I really haven't read a newspaper since the election. I mean, I think I speak for most people who work in politics or hardcore political observers. Once the election is over, you just sort of want to take a nap until like January 15th. So it's tough to sometimes follow, but I've picked up bits and pieces here. Now, General Petraeus, who basically could have won the presidency in a landslide a month ago if he had run, he could have run for the Republican or the Democratic Party. Incredibly well-respected, really, you know, the architect of the surge, and then started to slightly turn things around in Afghanistan. For a time, but there's just no helping a society that thinks that we are corrupt. Shocker. So Petraeus and this woman, who had never written a book in her life, start traveling a lot together because she's researching the book. And everybody thinks that it's kind of weird that he's got this lady writing a biography of him and she's never written anything before. And then after he became CIA director, supposedly they started an affair. Well, it turns out that she's absolutely out of her mind crazy. She starts... like, I forget some of the things that have gone on, but she just clearly is an insane person. She starts screaming at this woman who's like the Kim Kardashian of Tampa, apparently.
Yeah, no, so from what I understand is, yeah, so Petraeus, and it's got to remember, this all didn't happen at once. I guess this has been happening for a number of years, and it just got out. The press finally got it.
He's saying like that the they never day. Had any kind of adulterous affair until after he was out of uniform, so, because that would be...
So the real reason I think that, I mean, yeah, everybody likes a good scandal, but right. I think the reason I think it's important is that... I think.
Well,
I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Well, let's finish the whole the story here, okay? So this lady in Tampa, who apparently pals around with another 4-star general, was a pals with Petraeus. So the crazy biography lady starts sending really like nasty. Anonymous emails to this lady saying, "Why are Jill Kelly? Why are you screwing with my man? All that kind of stuff." So Jill Kelly gets freaked out, and she has a friend who's in the FBI. So she goes to her friend in the FBI and says, I'm getting these anonymous emails. They're threatening my life. Can you figure this out? So the FBI agent says, sure, but let me send you some shirtless pics first.
Yeah. It's like, it's so weird. It's like, it's seriously like something out of a soap opera.
Here's some topless photos of me, want to trade. And so he sends some topless photos of himself to her. And then he starts getting investigated. And then it all sort of snowballs, and they find out that Petraeus and the biographer, they find out that it's Petraeus' biographer. And then so they start going through all of her email accounts, and they find one email account that she never actually sends something from, but it just has a draft, this big draft that has, they basically, Petraeus and the biographer woman would log into an email account, and they would write each other a note, save the draft, and then log out. The other person would do the same and go on and on and on. They never deleted the draft, which is what got to him. So I'm just sitting here thinking the head of the CIA can't figure out how to delete a draft in a fake email. Like, it's you're almost smart.
And it was
you're
all almost it was sneaky. All Gmail.
You're almost sneaky.
That's what's so crazy, like, is it wasn't like some super government, you know, super secure email. It was Gmail.
I mean, at least it wasn't Hotmail. I mean, let's give him that. But like, so they find out that it's Petraeus, that it leaks, and now it's just like this whole thing. And, you know, here's why I think it matters. Normally, I wouldn't.
Well, hang on. There's actually more to
there's
it.
There's more?
There's more. So the Jill Kelly. So, yeah. So the girl's emailing Jill Kelly. Jill Kelly says FBI files emails back to Petraeus. He resigns. And under the assumption that he resigns because of this affair. And everybody's like, why the heck is he resigning over this? I mean, whoop-de-doo. You're not the president. This
right.
Year. So they kind of have that, but put that aside for a minute. I just read yesterday that now Jill Kelly's twin sister could have been in a relationship with Chris Christie.
Shut
or no,
up.
Not Chris Christie.
Okay, weird.
Got Charlie Crist of Florida. So Jill Kelly, because they're in Florida, they live in Florida. So Jill Kelly's twin sister could have had a relationship with Charlie Crist, and now Charlie Crist is entangled in this whole thing.
Charlie Crist, I hear, is a playboy.
So, I mean, it's just like, it really feels like something like a soap opera.
Right.
It's everything keeps getting tangled together, and it's just, it's kind of ridiculous.
God, how amazing would it have been if it,
it
had
Monica
been Chris
Lewinsky,
Christie.
It makes the Monica Lewinsky scandal just like, not even.
How do you think Chris Christie's doing today now that Hostess is out of business?
Oh, he's probably sad.
He's like, forget Sandy. This is the worst devastation New Jersey has ever seen.
But to the Petraeus, the reason that the Petraeus thing matters is one, is two things. Is there? I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, so I'm still skeptical about this implication. But why is the FBI, you know, investigating an affair? You know, they're the freaking FBI. Mm-hmm. And why would they care about an affair?
Right.
Now, they're trying to say that it's possible that Petraeus gave classified information.
Yeah,
it sounds like that's an out, because at the same time, I read this article the other day that why did this come out right after the election? Why did it come out right when they were going to interview Petraeus for
Benghazi?
Now he can plead the fifth if he wants, because he's no longer he's just a
director.
Civilian now. So there's a lot of things that are kind of shady about it. The real question I thought of after I saw this article, I think it was on the Daily Caller, is one of the things that people hated about the Bush administration was using black sites, which were CIA.
It's always color with you.
Yeah, which
was such a racist.
They were basically, they would use installations in, you know, embassies or bases in other countries as basically holding anybody without charge. You know, they just hold them there. And it was, everybody thought it was terrible. And Obama said he's not doing that anymore. Well, there have been kind of leaks getting out from, I think, the biographer, that Obama actually was using the Benghazi Libya embassy as a place to hold basically terrorists.
Really?
So that's not substantiated. So it's still kind of, it's all hearsay at the moment. Based upon this biographer. But if that does hold true, it makes a lot of sense as to why Obama basically, because they're like, why didn't the White House hear about this? And Petraeus stepping down, now he can plead the fifth. And if they interview him, they subpoena him for the Benghazi stuff. It makes a lot of sense. Now, again, I'm still skeptical because none of it's been substantiated. It is all basically up in the air. But that would be very, very, very important. And I mean, that would kind of, black Mark Obama's term
again.
I mean, it'd be racist. Ridiculous.
I think the problem with Petraeus, and this is sort of the issue that I had with Clinton, is I don't really care about your personal life. I think it's, you know, men, what is it, like 40% of men have an affair or something, some ridiculous statistic. So I guess I personally would never do that, and I find it horrible. It's a lack of character. You know, so it's not ideal to have a president or a CIA head who has a significant lack of character when it comes to loyalty and respect and honesty. The problem for us as a society is when you have somebody like a CIA director or a president, you don't want them to have anything that can be used to blackmail them. And this is something that could be used to blackmail a CIA director. When they went to her apartment and she turned over the biographer, they turned over her Broadwell's laptop.
Like that, yeah.
They found documents that were classified on her laptop. Now she has security clearances because she's around him and was his biographer, and so she has to have security clearances. But does she really need those if she's not his biographer anymore? I mean, does she really need access to classified documents if she's not writing about him? Or what is the nature of these documents? Do they pertain directly to him? I would think that a biographer would only need access to classified information if it's spoken in front of her. Wouldn't need access to documents. So that's the problem, is that, you know, and secondly, other CIA agents or FBI agents, what access to classified information that do their spouses or significant others have? So that's really the bottom line issue. And I don't think for a minute that there isn't more to the Benghazi story. I mean, this is the fact that we're not talking about Fast and Furious, we're not talking about Benghazi. If this had been George Bush, there would have been impeachment papers drawn up already. You know, the media, maybe it's good that there is a sex scandal aspect to this so we can actually have a conversation about Benghazi.
But they're going to do everything they can to ignore that. I mean, they're going to do everything they can to not talk about it.
I mean,
the media has been, Glenn Greenwald's, you know, it's kind of his pet issue. The media has been atrocious, worse than a child, worse than a high school reporter.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to these civil liberty things on Obama. And it's because they're carrying his water. They're carrying the water for Obama.
It's the only explanation.
Because they don't want him to come out and seem like what he actually is, which is a freaking despot when it comes to civil liberties.
We can't blow the myth that Democrats are good on civil liberties and anti-war.
And it all gets relegated to, like, internet forums where people who are basically just rabble-rousing libertarians talking to liberals, and then that's where it gets relegated to. It doesn't get into the mainstream media. And the only reason it can be is because they want to carry Obama's weight for him.
And then when you have those conversations about there might be some sort of cover-up, you're equated with the people who think that a drone hit a house on the south side of Indianapolis and killed a school teacher. I mean, it's – and that's – we've had this discussion about conspiracy theories.
And the bad thing is all this civil liberty stuff is out there. It's public record. You can go look. You can go look and see that his administration has had an assassination list. The NDAA is law. You can read it. You know, these things, they are out there for you to go read and look at. I mean, the fact that no one does, and the fact that the media won't do it, it just shows how much of a handicap Obama gets because of this, because
he's
a
Democrat.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's because he's a Democrat, and you know, you look at one of the moderators for the debates, Obama went to her wedding. I mean, it's not liberal bias. What people have to understand is that most of the media is not biased towards the left. The media is biased towards power. The media is biased towards power because they want access. You know, when you start going after and investigating and floating theories and talking about public officials, you get shut down and you get shut out. And these people make a living on providing information about the government, so they don't want to go and investigate public officials. And in a town like Indianapolis, where it's a real small town, and there's 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people maybe that make up the, you know, sort of the political class in the city, and there's maybe 25 reporters. Your competition is pretty stiff. You don't want to go out and investigate Greg Ballard, because then you're never going to get an interview with the mayor or any information from the city again. You don't want to go after Mitch Daniels or Mike Pence, because then you're going to be shut out and you're never going to get access or information again. You've got to make a living, so you better be nice to him. And that's the problem that we have, is that reporters, it's sort of always been that way. We have this myth that journalism was somehow at some point, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, and it may have been that way in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but it's, you know, before that you had yellow journalism. That's really the problem that we face as a society, is that, especially because media is financed like a for-profit enterprise, media is never going to go after people like they should. And it makes it harder to sort out the truth, because then you go to the internet, Alex Jones becomes as much of an information source as the Huffington Post or, you know, some other site.
Now, since you bring him up, I'm going to try and piss off some of our listeners. Alex Jones is crazy, and don't listen to him.
Exactly. Please. Please, dear sweet baby Jesus, if you have Alex Jones on your podcast feed and you're listening to him because you think he's a good source of information,
stop it.
Here's a person who just called for an armed revolution against the United States.
No, this guy, I swear to God, this is actually in his radio history, said that the federal government is putting, I think, fluoride in Juicy Juices in order to make people gay and control the population.
That is true. I saw the video of him saying that.
He straight up took, he took a drink of the Juicy Juices. Now I feel like I don't really want to have sex now. I swear to God.
I know. He did. Look it up. Look it up. He said, the government is turning you gay. Go look it up.
This guy is not a friend of liberty, all right? So stop listening to him. All right. Ran over.
And
I'm done.
The problem that I have with my problem is not so much with Alex Jones. It's with people like Ron Paul that go on his show and legitimize him.
Yeah,
I mean, I think
true.
Gary Johnson's been on. I think Rand Paul's been on. Like, stop legitimizing the guy. I mean, maybe every once in a broken clock is right twice a day, so maybe every now and then he's got some good information on Prison Planet or InfoWars or whatever. But I just have a very low view of that kind of, you know, conversation. So,
well, I guess we can segue into the main story, which is that
other than Hostess cupcakes?
Yes, other than Hostess, Mr. Ron Paul gave his farewell address the other day.
You're going to have to carry the water, because yeah. I didn't actually get a chance to watch it yet.
You didn't watch it?
No.
Well,
we've been moving offices.
Yeah.
We've been moving offices from the Rupert for Governor 3,500 square foot office over to, what would you say the square footage of this is? 400?
12?
Maybe 1,200 if we're lucky.
No, 12 feet.
12 feet, yeah. I mean, it's tiny. Creighton walked in and he's like, oh my God. And it's tiny over here. So it's basically from 2 days before the election, I started moving things over to this office and organizing, and like, it's been a process. So I really haven't had a chance to sit down and watch it. We did post on WeAreLibertarians.com an accurate representation of what he said.
No, okay. So for those, everyone can go watch it. We can post links to the video on the Facebook page, but I mean, they're all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's his farewell address.
Right.
It was like 48 minutes long. It was very unorganized, which is one of the reasons that you love and hate Ron Paul, is that
right.
He is so, you know, he knows what he's talking about, but he has no organization about it.
He is such a great champion for liberty. What a great spokesman. But what a terrible spokesman for
Yes, he is. He is not the greatest of speakers. But nevertheless, he was getting his stuff on the public record.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have taken note. A lot of mainstream journalists have taken note and actually said, you know, this is stuff that people should think about. And the best part was at the end, he basically said, you know, he basically said F, like, he didn't say F you, but he might as well have said F you to all the Democrats and all the Republicans.
F you, you're cool, F you.
No, he might as well, at the very end, I mean, go read this transcript, go watch the video, it's not going to ruin your life, it's really good, and he covers every one of your issues, and he was Trent. Thank you, Ron Paul was trending on Twitter while I was doing it, so it was really cool. It was a cool experience. But we got plenty of time, and I can hold the water for this little part here. So while I was watching it, I kind of wanted to post on my blog like a thank you, Ron Paul kind of thing, and I kind of got carried away with it. And it started to turn into, like, a speech that I would want to give. And it's not too long, and I feel like I should read it because it sounds elegant. And
if I do say so myself, it sounds very elegant.
But it kind of sums up my whole perspective on, like, where the Liberty Movement's at the moment and what we need to do. And so take it or leave it. You can fast forward through it if you want. It's probably going to take me maybe 3 to 4 minutes to read it.
Here's the photo that I was thinking of. There's a picture of Ron Paul called Congress a bunch of psychopathic authoritarians to their faces in his farewell address.
Yeah.
And he literally did that.
Yeah, no, he did. It was great. You gotta love the man. Okay, so, I mean, if you don't really want to listen to me say this, then just fast forward through it. But it's only going to take like 3 minutes to read. But it's really good, and it's kind of some food for thought for our listeners, our glorious band of listeners. So on Wednesday, November 14th, 2012, a man said goodbye. Standing at the lectern where he stood so many times before in obstinate opposition, like an American Cicero, to the decline of the Republic that so many had fought so hard to build and so many have given so much to preserve, this man spoke not only to the gallery above or the people sitting at home, but through the pages of history to every yet unborn child who may grow and learn of what it takes to save their country. And to the extent that it was in his control, he held firm in his convictions, even when he was standing alone in the cold wilderness of principle that exists in an age of compromise and vice. Freedom was his call, and for a time nobody listened, for a time nobody cared. Yet he was only a man. Let us not place him upon the mantle of history as anything more than that. For what is it that we fight? Against whom do we fight? Do we not fight for ourselves and for others so as to be able to live in peace and happiness? Without the burden of a tyrannical state, do we not fight the hordes of those seeking to take from us everything we have? In short, do we not fight in order to be simply a man or a woman, to be simple and human, to be left alone? Then do not betray that noble cause. Do not destroy the integrity of its pursuit by placing those most articulate and passionate in its defense upon a mantle of history as anything more than what they were. For the real battle is not in preserving the credibility and image of our greatest of warriors on the tempestuous battlefield of liberty, but in providing for our posterity a nation of one people united in their stand against those that would take away their liberty. In other words, we need not one man, but hundreds, thousands, millions of people dedicated to the virtue of our republic as the ultimate attempt to hold back the vices of men and bind them down with the chains of law. We need a moral people, a principled people, who are not so easily swayed towards the ease of avarice and dependence, but have the character to ignore the false promises of security and luxury that the merchants of slavery will use in an attempt to steal their republic from them. The fight is not one that is short and dramatic, but is long, enduring, and obstinate.
Not dramatic at all.
No. Benjamin Franklin alluded that a people who believe in freedom is necessary to the sustainment of the Constitution, as he told a passerby after the Constitutional Convention that he had given us a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. Indeed, it requires more than the Constitution, for without a people who have a tenacious passion for freedom and the intellectual rigor required to defend it, the Constitution is nothing more than an eloquently worded sheet of paper ready to be destroyed for the next snake oil salesman promising us utopia if only they could take away our freedom to do it. This is not to say that the virtue of one man cannot be advertised to those yet uninformed of the cause that is required of them should they desire their God-given right of freedom. Indeed, it is often one man or one woman that does more to change opinion and set ablaze the brush fire in people's minds than any army could ever do. This man, however, was more than a spokesman or a salesman. He was more than an eloquent messenger of liberty. He was an archetype of what is required to secure it. So if his example be followed at all, then let it be because his actions serve as reminders to all of us that there is no maximum that one can give for this movement, and to secure it, we must attempt to give more than we ever thought possible. Patriotism is not without hardship. And since it's going to be our responsibility to fight this fight in the future, I think it merits discussion on what we need to become if we're to continue. As I have said, we must recognize that the fight will be long and difficult. that this does not mean in the face of enormous adversity that we're that we are any more forgiven if we sacrifice ourselves to our enemies simply because it has become too hard. There used to be a time when this truth was self-evident, when the strongest, most powerful army in the world marched up to their doorstep, the weak buckled and strove to do everything they could to avoid the conflict before them. They sought every means to avoid fighting for what was rightfully theirs. However, for those who would succumb to cowardice, there existed those that would explain to them that the cause is far more noble than safety to which they should pursue. In words that should echo in the heads of every freedom-loving American, to this day, one of the more eloquent defenders of freedom shouted, "Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, so as to be bought at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Furthermore, do not believe those who may tell you that the cause of liberty is radical and unjust, that it is inequitable and selfish, or at worst, idealistic. We do not seek some utopian ideal, some unheard-of radical departure from what it means to be American. Liberty is America's oldest tradition. Resistance to tyranny, her birthing virtue. We need not look further than the Declaration of Independence itself for proof of this claim, that these values were merely an exposition of what Thomas Jefferson called the American mind. In short, it is not we who must explain ourselves to the salesmen of equity and security, but they who must explain themselves to us. We have tradition on our side. This country is ours. It is they who must explain to us why liberty is so at odds with their goals and that they must dismantle it in order to succeed. I, for one, will never lose my suspicion. No goal is so noble and important that I must sacrifice my liberty to achieve it. John F. Kennedy once said, "There is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. There is no value in the survival of America if we must destroy the tradition of liberty to do so. Indeed, it would only serve to make America a shell, a hollow effigy of what it once was. Because America is more than the land beneath our feet. America is an idea, nay, it is an ideal. America was built upon the foundations of liberty, where the state exists not to take from you what you have, but to protect the liberty that is your right. If we are to survive as a nation, then we must unite behind the banner that united us from our beginning, liberty. Indeed, I cannot say it any better than Mr. Franklin said so long ago, where liberty dwells, that is my country. I say let it dwell here again, for if we fail to preserve freedom, then mankind will lose it forever. We are its last hope, America. If it dies here, it dies for good. And this is why we must never falter and we must never give up. We must put away our petty differences. Race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, liberty welcomes you all. It is not the nature of individualism to look at someone's similarities to another group and assume that they are identical, nor is it in the nature of liberty to restrict the freedom of other peaceful individuals simply because of this difference. These are the vices of collectivism. But more than demographics, we must put away our pride. Those most active on the front of liberty, and you know who you are threatening the goals they universally understand to be right for sheer lack of common sense. A wiser man than I once said, "I never considered a difference of opinion in politics, in religion, in philosophy, as a cause for withdrawing from a friend." We must not succumb to the damages that befall the proud. Correctness in the face of each other is irrelevant if it is only with each other that we prove ourselves to be correct. To succeed, we must grow, but we cannot grow if the foundations of our pursuits are continuously cut from beneath us, if only so some may save face. So we live in an age that could become legendary in the history of this great country. We are the heirs to the revolution that was fought so long ago. Yet it is not over. It did not end at Yorktown. The revolution was more than a fight against a country, but it was a fight for an idea. While there exist threats to freedom, then the fight will continue. So what shall we do? Ron Paul has said goodbye. He has passed the torch on to us. It is our turn to hold back the tide of despotism. It is our turn to fight for what is right. He has given all he could, and more than was ever required of him. The time has come to continue his fight, our fight, America's fight. We must put away our petty differences. We must unite in the pursuit of that noblest of American traditions. I want to thank Mr. Paul one final time, and to echo his sentiments. May future generations look back upon our efforts. May they see a people which stood up to the politicians and special interests, and may they be able to say that they saved their country. And that is my long-winded speech.
Very nice. You wrote that?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes.
You didn't get that from Thomas Jefferson?
some of the quotes were Thomas Jefferson.
That's very good. Very nice. I'm going to have to post that separately. I think we ought to just end it there. That was great. So, like I said, we're taking a hiatus. If that was TLDR, too long didn't read, or TLDL, Ron Paul was not a great speaker. Ron Paul was not a great political organizer. Ron Paul wasn't a great fundraiser. Ron Paul didn't really get much passed in Congress.
And he admitted it himself in the farewell speech. So go ahead and read it and watch it.
But Ron Paul was successful because a bunch of libertarians, small and big L libertarians, got off their ass and did something.
Because he, if anything, for everything he lacked in his eloquence or his ability to play politics, he made up for it in his honesty and his integrity. And that is the God's honest truth. Is the reason he had such a fervent following was because he was just an honest guy who believed in liberty. And he went to Washington to fight for it. And he may not have gotten anything passed, but
politics is a constant test of integrity. We've talked about it a lot. And it tests your principles. It tests your character. It tests who you are. It's the people business. And you've got to maintain your integrity, and you've got to maintain your principles if you want to make a difference. And Ron Paul proved that. And now that Ron Paul is retiring and heading off into the sunset, doesn't mean that this ends. It just means that it continues. So
no, yeah, and I mean, Ron Paul. I mean, everybody had to know that Ron Paul wasn't going to be able to do it forever.
Right,
and he did it for so long, and he did it by himself for so much of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to give them. You cannot. It's impossible to explain the respect you have for the guy for 30 plus years, standing in front of the most evil people in America, and telling them that this is what we need to do, and being the only guy saying it, and never once faltering in that ever. I mean, that is
people.
They make movies about people like that.
People over the last 4 years. I've been the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana for 4 years now. And the question is constantly asked, why are you doing it? Why are the libertarians, why do we exist as a party? What are you have these candidates and they run to win, but they always lose. What's the point? And the point is that in our running, we help influence the policy discussions that go on. We help influence the people that do get elected. We also keep the torch lit for what America truly stands for, which is what you talked about in your soliloquy. We also are growing and building a party, and it takes time and it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a toll on people. And you are now starting to see the fruits of the Libertarian Party over the last 40 years, over the Libertarian movement, not just the party, but the movement. People like Ron Paul, people like the Mises Institute, people like Cato and Reason, you know, all these various Libertarian groups, the advocates for self-government, you're starting to see that fruit. You're seeing the presidential and the gubernatorial race here in Indiana. You saw double the amount of voters. You know, we broke 1 million votes in the presidential race for the Libertarian Party. That's what it's about. It's a slow build. It's not easy, but it's keeping the torch lit. It's influencing policy, and it's building towards something. Because if we want to keep the republic, we have to put the republic on the ballot. You have to vote your principles. You have to vote for those policies. And that's what it truly is about.
And, I mean, and like I said, you know, Ron Paul stands as an example of what is required for people to do that. Like I said, 30 years and not getting one thing really done except holding his ground and never faltering. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, it takes time, but people notice it and look what happened because mm-hmm. of it. I mean, 90% of the people that listen to this podcast that, you know, are in the Libertarian Party that are in, you know, that any, this Liberty movement,
it exists
because it exists to the strength it does because of Ron Paul.
Well, and it, not just Ron Paul, but the people who have been influenced by him, and then they take the message and they go tell someone else. And if you're listening, you've got to go tell someone else. You've got to tell them about websites, the quiz, this podcast, you know,
I mean,
the Cato Institute, Mises, tell people about libertarian organizations where they can get information
and
bug
get involved
them.
Yourself.
And please, I mean, that's, dear sweet God, get involved.
That's the main thing is, I mean, Ron Paul did more than just, you know, it's not like he just went out there and he talked about some ideas that never anybody never heard before. That happened. He did that
right.
a lot. But he ignited something in so many people, again, just by being an honest, you know, guy with integrity. He just ignited something in people now that people want to go out and they want to affect change for the better.
Right.
It's not that they just want to say, I was right. And there are a lot of people in this movement that is their only thing.
And the best thing about what's happening right now is the millennial generation, our generation. We are less profit-driven. We're more purpose-driven, where we want to impact the world. And if we can make money while doing it, great. But if not, we're going to do it anyways. You know, this is a generation shaped by libertarian cultural influences. It's ready to vote libertarian. It's been influenced by Ron Paul. It's been influenced by Gary Johnson. And it's a very giving, charitable generation. And I talked about our disappointment after Election Day. And there's disappointment. There is. We had higher hopes than what we accomplished. But the future is so incredibly bright. You look at Ron Paul retiring, and some people will say, well, then it's just the end. It's over. But then you talk about Flake and Amash and all the people who have been influenced by Ron Paul who are going to learn the lesson that Ron Paul had, Rand Paul. You were just, when we were in a break, reading all the news stories from what Rand Paul is doing, where Rand is holding bills and putting a stop to bills and, you know, keeping things from being outlawed and fighting regulations.
Yeah, right now
that's what it's about.
Right now he is trying to put a hold on a defense bill until he gets a vote on whether or not indefinite detainees will get fair trials.
Right.
I mean that's
what it's about.
That is, you know, you would never see that, you know, before people like Rand Paul and Justin Amash got there. Mm-hmm. Never. Ron Paul would have been the only guy doing it.
Yep.
And, I mean, it really just speaks to how much we have grown. And, I mean, it's nice to say that Ron Paul is, I mean, he is, of our generation, the guy that is, like, the figurehead. And, like I said, don't put him on the mantle as anything more than human, because this movement is a grassroots movement. He mm-hmm. was just the face of it for a while. But this has been, like I said, this is liberty is America's oldest tradition. This is the same fight that people were having back in the beginning of America. It's the same fight that people have been fighting for throughout the 20th century. I mean, this is stuff that people have been doing for so long, and now it's finally regaining some strength. I mean,
right.
After so many losses, it's finally there. I mean, it really is a testament to the fact that throughout human history, liberty will never die as something to be aspired to. Because no matter how much the state, I mean, even through the face of Nazism, through socialism in Russia, in the face of, you know, our president saying that he can kill people at will, even through all of that.
And write it down and nobody in Congress gives a crap.
But even through all of that, there are still people out there that believe in, you know, in freedom, and they haven't had it worked from their system by decades and decades of, you know, state growth.
Each and every person, and let's end with this, each and every person listening is gifted in some way. You may not be a podcaster, you may be a writer, you may be a person that is good at ordering yard signs for candidates. You may be a person that's good at data entry. You may be good at writing. You may be good at video editing. Whatever it is, you've got some skill. You've got some gift that you can give to the libertarian movement. And the only thing keeping you from being a significant individual in the libertarian movement is yourself. You've just got to make the commitment to give the time. You know, we don't get a dime for doing this, but we want to do a little show that we have fun doing, but helps explain what libertarians think about the news
and
examine the news to help give you some information about what, you know, what different libertarian points of view think about certain things. I mean, I'm not the same type of libertarian as Creighton, but...
And obviously me and Galt don't agree on everything.
No, I mean, sometimes it comes to blows between these two, but...
And this, again, this comes back to my point I made in my little soliloquy, as you called it. That, and everyone who's been a libertarian for 5 minutes knows that some libertarians hate each other.
Right.
And we I mean, everybody always says, and it's kind of like a good pat on the back, oh, look what you said kind of thing. But it's true. We can't afford to have that kind of crap.
Right.
I mean, you know, people like the Mises Institute fighting with, you know,
Cato.
GMU and Cato.
The Stato Institute.
Yeah. I mean, I understand there is bad blood between, you know,
right.
Mises and Cato. And if you don't know the history of that, read up on it. It has a lot to do with Murray Rothbard. And Murray Rothbard plays into a lot of bad blood issues.
There's a lot of contention and seeds that were planted in the 70s by Murray that are still blossoming today.
But at the same time, it's like we all want the same thing.
Right.
And it's not like we don't want – it's not like we have – I mean, we can't fight with each other just so we can save face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it is.
You've got to put – not everybody's going to always agree with you. Not everybody's going to get along. But you've got to put your own ego aside. You've got to let people do their thing. And when you're managing volunteers, and this is all volunteer, I mean, I'm paid by the Libertarian Party of Indiana, but mostly I volunteer. Like, I get paid for about Monday.
I don't get paid
for
nothing.
I get paid for like Monday and Tuesday, and then I volunteer Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But I do it because I'm passionate about it and I want to make a difference. And, you know, everybody else is in the same boat. And, you know, we've got to have honest conversations with each other and just come to constructive criticism and make it constructive and move past it.
Because we never lose sight of the goal. You know, no matter how much you may dislike somebody, no matter how down you may get because Obamacare got held up as constitutional, or, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki is assassinated, proving that the assassination was, no matter how down you may get, just never lose sight of the goal. And hopefully everybody who's in this fight is fighting for the same reason, which is just liberty, you
right.
know, freedom. And, you know, that's the goal. So never lose sight of that. And whenever you feel like crap, just remember that while you're here, sitting here, not doing anything, feeling down for yourself, there are people out there working hard to grow the state, to take away your freedom. And it's kind of like what Bob Marley said. If they're not taking a day off, how can we? So,
all right, we'll end there. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for downloading this episode. Please share the episode and get this message out. Even if you're not going to share the episode to promote the podcast, take it and share the idea with your friends, and keep all of your Facebook friends motivated to keep working. So,
happy Thanksgiving, Merry Christmas,
Happy Thanksgiving, Merry
New
Christmas,
Year.
Happy New Year. We'll see you guys sometime in January. Thanks.
Any music run in?
Yeah, my iPad got stolen, so...
Really?
Oh, really?
I'm going to have to... Yeah, you guys didn't know that?
No.
Halloween night, I'm at my church, Christ United Methodist on the south side. Someone breaks my driver's side window, steals my backpack, has my little orange recorder, it had my iPad, it had my planner, my pad folio thing for my legal pad with all my notes, my smart pen... And then it tracked it to 21st in Alabama, and the cops still have not called me back.
Ugh.
They haven't done anything.
That's so, police for you.
So I'm gonna have to edit in the music. So
all right. Looking for a new tablet?
Yes, I mean, a new iPad.
If we're going back to the good old days, I got stuff.
No, I'm gonna edit in the theme. So
all right.
This podcast is produced by What Is a Hoosier Productions.